This is Audible.
I Am Malala, written by Malala Yousafzai, with Christina Lam, and read by Archie Punjabi, with the prologue read by Malala Yousafzai. To all the girls who have faced injustice and been silenced, together we will be heard. Prologue.
I am Malala. I come from a country which was created at midnight. When I almost died, it was just after midday. 1 year ago, I left my home for school and never returned. I was shot in the head by a Taliban bullet and was flown out of Pakistan unconscious. Some people say I will never return home, but I believe firmly in my heart that I will. To be torn from the country that you love is not something to wish on anyone. Now, every morning when I open my eyes, I long to see my old room full of my things, my clothes all over the floor and my school prizes on the shelves. Instead, I'm in a country which is 5 hours behind my beloved homeland, Pakistan, and my home in the Swat Valley. But my country is centuries behind this one. Here, there's every convenience you can imagine. Water running from every tap, hot or cold as you wish. Lights at the flick of a switch. Day and night, no need of oil lamps. Ovens to cook on. They don't need anyone to go and fetch gas cylinders from the bazaar. Here, everything is so modern. One can even find food ready cooked in packets. When I stand in front of my window and look out, I see tall buildings, long roads full of vehicles moving in orderly lines, neat green hedges and lawns, and tidy pavements to walk on. I close my eyes and for a moment, I'm back in my valley. The high snow-topped mountains, green waving fields and fresh blue rivers. And my heart smiles when it looks at the people of Swat. My mind transports me back to my school. And there I am, reunited with my friends and teachers. I meet my best friend Muniba. And we sit together, talking and joking as if I had never left. Then I remember I am in Birmingham, England. The day when everything changed was Tuesday, the 9th of October, 2012. It wasn't the best of days to start with as it was the middle of school exams. Though, as a bookish girl, I didn't mind them as much as some of my classmates. That morning, we arrived in the narrow mud lane of Haji Baba Road in our usual procession of brightly painted rickshaws, sputtering diesel fumes, each one crammed with 5 or 6 girls. Since the time of the Taliban, our school has had no sign. And the ornamented brass door in a white wall across from the woodcutter's yard gives no hint of what lies beyond. For us girls, that doorway was like a magical entrance to our own special world. As we skipped through, we cast off our headscarves like winds puffing away clouds to make way for the sun. Then rain helter-skelter up the steps. At the top of the steps was an open courtyard with doors to all the classrooms. We dumped our backpacks in our rooms, then gathered for morning assembly under the sky. Our backs to the mountains as we stood to attention. One girl commanded, "Asan Bash," or "Stand at ease." And we clicked our heels and responded, "Allah." Then she said, "Hoshyar," or "Attention." And we clicked our heels again Allah. The school was founded by my father before I was born, and on the wall above us, Khushal School, was painted proudly in red and white letters. We went to school 6 mornings a week, and as a 15-year-old in year 9, my classes were spent chanting chemical equations or studying Urdu grammar, writing stories in English with morals like haste makes waste, or drawing diagrams of blood circulation. Most of my classmates wanted to be doctors. It's hard to imagine that anyone would see that as a threat. Yet, outside the door to the school, lay not only the noise and craziness of Mingora, the main city of Swat, but also those like the Taliban who think girls should not go to school. That morning had begun like any other, though a little later than usual. It was exam time, so school started at 9 instead of 8, which was good as I don't like getting up and can sleep through the crows of the cocks and the prayer calls of the muezzin. First, my father would try to rouse me. "Time to get up, Janiman," he would say. This means soulmate in Persian. And he always called me that at the start of the day. "A few more minutes, Abba, please," I would beg, then burrow deeper under the quilt. Then my mother, Torpekai, would come. "Pisho," she would call. This means cat, and is her name for me. At this point, I would realize the time and shout, "Babi, I'm late." In our culture, every man is your brother and every woman your sister. That's how we think of each other. When my father first brought his wife to school, all the teachers referred to her as my brother's wife or Bhabi. That's how it stayed from then on. We all call her Bhabi now. I slept in the long room at the front of our house, and the only furniture was a bed and a cabinet, which I had bought with some of the money I had been given as an award for campaigning for peace in our valley and the right for girls to go to school. On some shelves were all the gold-colored plastic cups and trophies I had won for coming first in my class. There were a few times I had not come top, times when I was beaten by my class rival, Malkai Noor. I was determined it would not happen again. The school was not far from my home, and I used to walk. But since the start of last year, I had gone by bus. It was a journey of just 5 minutes along the stinky stream, past the giant billboard for Dr. Humayun's Hair Transplant Institute, where we joked that one of our bald male teachers must have gone when he suddenly started to sprout hair. I liked the bus because I didn't get as sweaty as when I walked, and I could chat with my friends and gossip with Usman Ali, the driver, who we called Bhaijaan or brother. He made us all laugh with his crazy stories. I had started taking the bus because my mother was scared of me going to school on my own. We had been getting threats all year. Some were in the newspapers, some were notes or messages passed on by people. My mother was worried about me, but the Taliban had never come for a girl, and I was more concerned that they would target my father, as he was always speaking out against them. His close friend and fellow campaigner, Zahid Khan, had been shot in the face in August on his way to prayers, and I knew everyone was telling my father, "Take care, you will be the next." Our street could not be reached by car, so coming home, I would get off the bus on the road below by the stream and go through a barred iron gate. I thought, if anyone attacked me, it would be on those steps. Like my father, I have always been a daydreamer. And sometimes in lessons, my mind would drift. And I would imagine that on the way home, a terrorist might jump out and shoot me on those steps. I wondered what I would do. Maybe I would take off my shoes and hit him. But then I would think, if I did that, there would be no difference between me and a terrorist. It would be better to plead. Okay, shoot me. But first, listen to me. What you are doing is wrong. I'm not against you. I just want every girl to go to school. I wasn't scared, but I had started making sure the gate was locked at night and asking God what happens when you die. I told my best friend Muniba everything. We'd lived on the same street when we were little and been friends since birth. And we shared everything, Justin Bieber songs and Twilight movies, the best face lightening creams. Her dream was to be a fashion designer, although she knew her family would never agree to it. So she told everyone she wanted to be a doctor. It's hard for girls in our society to be anything other than teachers or doctors if they can work at all. I was different. I never hid my desire when I changed from wanting to be a doctor to wanting to be an inventor or a politician. Muniba always knew if something was wrong. "Don't worry," I told her. "The Taliban have never come for a small girl." When our bus was called, we ran down the steps. The other girls all covered their heads before emerging from the door and climbing up into the back. The bus was actually what we call a Dyna, a white Toyota Town Ace truck with three parallel benches, one along either side and one in the middle. It was crammed with 20 girls and three teachers. I was sitting on the left between Muniba and a girl from the year below called Shazia Ramzan, with our exam folders cradled in our arms. After that, it is all a bit hazy. I remember that inside the diner was hot and sticky. The cooler days were late coming, and only the faraway mountains of the Hindu Kush had a frosting of snow. The back where we sat had no windows, just thick plastic sheeting at the sides, which flapped and was too yellowed and dusty to see through. All we could see was a little stamp of open sky out of the bag and glimpses of the sun. At that time of day, a yellow orb floating in the dust that streamed over everything. I remember that the bus turned right off the main road at the army checkpoint, as always, and rounded the corner past the deserted cricket ground. I don't remember anymore. In my dreams about the shooting, my father is also in the bus, and he is shot with me. And then there are men everywhere, and I'm searching for my father. In reality, what happened was we suddenly stopped. On our left was the tomb of Sher Muhammad Khan, the finance minister of the first ruler of Swat, all overgrown with grass, and on our right, the snack factory. We must have been less than 200 meters from the checkpoint. We couldn't see in front, but a young man with a goatee beard in light-colored clothes had stepped into the road and waved the van down. "Is this the Khushal school bus?" he asked our driver. Usman Bhaijaan thought this was a stupid question, as the name was painted on the side. "Yes," he said. "I need information about some children," said the man. You should go to the office, said Usman Bhaijan. As he was speaking, another young man in white approached the back of the van. Look, it's one of those journalists coming to ask for an interview, said Muniba. Since I had started speaking at events with my father to campaign for girls' education and against those like the Taliban who want to hide us away, journalists often came, even foreigners, though not like this in the road. The man was wearing a peaked cap. He looked like a college student. Then he swung himself onto the tailboard at the back and leaned in right over us. Who is Malala? He demanded. No one said anything, but several of the girls looked at me. I was the only girl with my face not covered. That is when he lifted up a black pistol. I later learned it was a Colt 45. Some of the girls screamed. Muniba tells me I squeezed her hand. My friends say he fired 3 shots, one after another. The first went through my left eye socket and embedded under my left shoulder. I slumped forward onto Muniba, blood coming from my left ear. Saw the other 2 bullets hit the girls next to me. 1 bullet went into Shazia's left hand. The 3rd went through her left shoulder and into the upper right arm of Kainat Riaz. My friends later told me that the gunman's hand was shaking as he fired. By the time we got to the hospital, my long hair and Muniba's lap were full of blood. Who is Malala? I am Malala, and this is my story.
Part 1. Rather I receive your bullet-riddled body with honor than news of your cowardice on the battlefield. Traditional Pashto couplet. 1. A daughter is born. When I was born, people in our village commiserated with my mother, and nobody congratulated my father. I arrived at dawn as the last star blinked out. We Pashtuns see this as an auspicious sign. My father didn't have any money for the hospital or for a midwife, so a neighbor helped at my birth. My parents' first child was stillborn, but I popped out kicking and screaming. I was a girl in a land where rifles are fired in celebration of a son, while daughters are hidden away behind a curtain, their role in life simply to prepare food and give birth to children. For most Pashtuns, it's a gloomy day when a daughter is born. My father's cousin, Jahan Sheikh Khan Yousafzai, was one of the few who came to celebrate my birth and even gave a handsome gift of money. Yet, he brought with him a vast family tree of our clan, the Dalokhel Yousafzai, going right back to my great-great-grandfather and showing only the male line. My father, Ziauddin, is different from most Pashtun men. He took the tree, drew a line like a lollipop from his name, and at the end of it he wrote, Malala. His cousin laughed in astonishment. My father didn't care. He says he looked into my eyes after I was born and fell in love. He told people, I know there is something different about this child. He even asked friends to throw dried fruit, sweets and coins into my cradle, something we usually only do for boys. I was named after Malalai of Maiwand, the greatest heroine of Afghanistan. Pashtuns are a proud people of many tribes split between Pakistan and Afghanistan. We live as we have for centuries by a code called Pashtunwali, which obliges us to give hospitality to all guests, and in which the most important value is nung, or honor. The worst thing that can happen to a Pashtun is loss of face. Shame is a very terrible thing for a Pashtun man. We have a saying, without honor, the world counts for nothing. We fight and feud among ourselves so much that our word for cousin, Tarbur, is the same as our word for enemy. But we always come together against outsiders who try to conquer our lands. All Pashtun children grow up with the story of how Malalai inspired the Afghan army to defeat the British in 1880 in one of the biggest battles of the Second Anglo-Afghan War. Malalai was the daughter of a shepherd in Maiwand, a small town on the dusty plains west of Kandahar. When she was a teenager, both her father and the man she was supposed to marry were among thousands of Afghans fighting against the British occupation of their country. Malalai went to the battlefield with other women from the village to tend the wounded and take them water. She saw their men were losing, and when the flag bearer fell, she lifted her white veil up high and marched onto the battlefield in front of the troops. "Young love," she shouted out, "if you do not fall in the battle of Maiwand, then by God, someone is saving you as a symbol of shame." Malalai was killed under fire, but her words and bravery inspired the men to turn the battle around. They destroyed an entire brigade, one of the worst defeats in the history of the British Army. The Afghans were so proud that the last Afghan king built a Maiwand victory monument in the center of Kabul. In high school, I read some Sherlock Holmes and laughed to see that it was the same battle where Dr. Watson was wounded before becoming partner to the great detective. In Malalai, we Pashtuns have our very own Joan of Arc. Many girls' schools in Afghanistan are named after her. My grandfather, who was a religious scholar and village cleric, did not like my father giving me that name. "It's a sad name," he said. "It means grief-stricken." When I was a baby, my father used to sing me a song written by the famous poet Rimat Shah Sayal of Peshawar. The last verse ends, "O Malala of Maiwand, rise once more to make Pashtuns understand the song of honor. Your poetic words turn worlds around. I beg you, rise again." My father told the story of Malalai to anyone who came to our house. I loved hearing the story and the songs my father sang me, and the way my name floated on the wind when people called it. We lived in the most beautiful place in all the world. My valley, the Swat Valley, is a heavenly kingdom of mountains, gushing waterfalls, and crystal clear lakes. "Welcome to paradise," it says on the sign as you enter the valley. In olden times, Swat was called Udyana, which means garden. We have fields of wildflowers, orchards of delicious fruit, emerald mines, and rivers full of trout. People often call Swat the Switzerland of the East. We even had Pakistan's first ski resort. The rich people of Pakistan came on holiday to enjoy our clean air and scenery and our Sufi festivals of music and dancing. And so did many foreigners, all of whom we call Angrezan, English, wherever they came from. Even the Queen of England came and stayed in the White Palace, built from the same marble as the Taj Mahal, by our king, the first Wali of Swat. We have a special history too. Today, Swat is part of the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, or KPK, as many Pakistanis call it. But Swat used to be separate from the rest of Pakistan. We were once a princely state, one of three with the neighboring lands of Chitral and Dhir. In colonial times, our kings owed allegiance to the British, but ruled their own land. When the British gave India independence in 1947 and divided it, we went with the newly created Pakistan, but stayed autonomous. We used the same Pakistani rupee, but the government of Pakistan could only intervene on foreign policy. The Wali administered justice, kept the peace between warring tribes, and collect ushur, a tax of 10% of income, with which he built roads, hospitals, and schools. We were only 100 miles from Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, as the crow flies, but it felt as if it was in another country. The journey took at least 5 hours by road over the Malakan Pass, a vast bowl of mountains, where long ago our ancestors, led by a preacher called Mullah Sadullah, known by the British as the Mad Fakir, battled British forces among the craggy peaks. Among them was Winston Churchill, who wrote a book about it, and we still call one of the peaks Churchill's Picket, even though he was not very complimentary about our people. At the end of the pass is a green-domed shrine, where people throw coins to give thanks for their safe arrival. No one I knew had been to Islamabad. Before the troubles came, most people, like my mother, had never been outside Swat. We lived in Mingora, the biggest town in the valley and the only city. It used to be a small place, but many people had moved in from surrounding villages, making it dirty and crowded. It has hotels, colleges, a golf course, and a famous bazaar for buying our traditional embroidery, gemstones, and anything you can think of. The Marhaza stream loops through it, milky brown from the plastic bags and rubbish thrown into it. It is not clear like the streams in the hilly areas or like the wide river Swat just outside town, where people fished for trout and which we visited on holidays. Our house was in Gulkada, which means place of flowers, but it used to be called Butkara, or the place of the Buddhist statues. Near our home was a field scattered with mysterious ruins, statues of lions on their haunches, broken columns, headless figures, and oddest of all, hundreds of stone umbrellas. Islam came to our valley in the 11th century when Sultan Mahmud of Ghazni invaded from Afghanistan and became our ruler. But in ancient times, Swat was a Buddhist kingdom. The Buddhists came here in the 2nd century and their kings ruled the valley for more than 500 years. Chinese explorers wrote stories of how there were 1,400 Buddhist monasteries along the banks of the river Swat. The magical sound of temple bells would ring out across the valley. The temples are long gone, but almost anywhere you go in Swat, amid all the primroses and other wild flowers, you find their remains. We would picnic among the rock carvings of a smiling fat Buddha cross-legged on a lotus flower. There are many stories that Lord Buddha himself came here because it is a place of such peace, and some of his ashes are said to be buried in the valley in a giant stupa. Our Butkara ruins were a magical place to play hide-and-seek. Once, some foreign archaeologists arrived to do some work there and told us that in times gone by, it was a place of pilgrimage, full of beautiful temples domed with gold, where Buddhist kings lay buried. My father wrote a poem, The Relics of Butkara, and summed up perfectly how temple and mosque could exist side by side. When the voice of truth rises from the minarets, the Buddha smiles and the broken chain of history reconnects. We lived in the shadow of the Hindu Kush Mountains, where the men went to shoot ibex and golden cockerels. Our house was one story and proper concrete. On the left were steps up to a flat roof big enough for us children to play cricket on. It was our playground. At dusk, my father and his friends often gathered to sit and drink tea there. Sometimes I sat on the rooftop watching the smoke rise from the cooking fires all around and listening to the nightly racket of the crickets. Our valley is full of fruit trees on which grow the sweetest figs and pomegranates and peaches, and in our garden we had grapes, guavas, and persimmons. There was a plum tree in our front yard which gave the most delicious fruit. It was always a race between us and the birds to get to them. The birds loved that tree, even the woodpeckers. For as long as I can remember, my mother has talked to the birds. At the back of the house was a veranda where the women gathered. We knew what it was like to be hungry, so my mother always cooked extra and gave food to poor families. If there was any left, she fed it to the birds. In Pashto, we love to sing tapi, two-line poems, and as she scattered the rice, she would sing a verse. Don't kill doves in the garden. You kill one, and the others won't come. I like to sit on the roof and watch the mountains and dream. The highest mountain of all was the pyramid-shaped Mount Elam. To us, it's a sacred mountain, and so high that it always wears a necklace of fleecy clouds. Even in summer, it's frosted with snow. At school, we learnt that in 327 BC, even before the Buddhists came to Swat, Alexander the Great swept into the valley with thousands of elephants and soldiers on his way from Afghanistan to the Indus. Swatis fled up the mountain, believing they would be protected by their gods because it was so high up. But Alexander was a determined and patient leader. He built a wooden ramp from which his catapults and arrows would reach the top of the mountain. Then he climbed up so he could catch hold of the star of Jupiter as a symbol of his power. From the rooftop, I watched the mountains change with the seasons. In the autumn, chill winds would come from the mountain. In the winter, everything was white snow, long icicles hanging from the roof like daggers, which we loved to snap off. We raced around building snowmen and snow bears and trying to catch snowflakes. Spring was when Swat was at its greenest. Eucalyptus blossom blew into the house, coating everything white, and the wind carried the pungent smell of the rice fields. I was born in summer, which was perhaps why it was my favorite time of the year, even though in Mingora, summer was hot and dry, and the streams stank where people dumped garbage. When I was born, we were very poor. My father and a friend had founded their first school, and we lived in a shabby shack of two rooms opposite the school. I slept with my mother and father in one room, and the other room was for guests. We had no bathroom or kitchen, and my mother cooked on a wood fire on the ground and washed our clothes at a tap in the school. Our home was always full of people visiting from the village. Hospitality is an important part of Pashtun culture. 2 years after I was born, my brother Khushal arrived. Like me, he was born at home, as we still could not afford the hospital, and he was named Khushal, like my father's school, after the Pashtun hero Khushal Khan Khattak, a warrior and poet. My mother had been waiting for a son and could not hide her joy when he was born. To me, he seemed very thin and small, like a reed that could snap in the wind. But he was the apple of her eye, her Ladla. It seemed to me that his every wish was her command. He wanted tea all the time, our traditional tea with milk and sugar and cardamom. But even my mother tired of this and eventually made some so bitter that he lost the taste for it. She wanted to buy a new cradle for him. When I was born, my father couldn't afford one, so they used an old wooden one of the neighbors that was already third or fourth hand. My father refused. Malala swung in that cradle, he said. So can he. Then nearly 5 years later, another boy was born. Atal, bright-eyed and inquisitive, like a squirrel. After that, said my father, we were complete. Three children is a small family by Swati standards, where most people have seven or eight. I played mostly with Khushal because he was just 2 years younger than me, but we fought all the time. He would go crying to my mother and I would go to my father. What's wrong, Jani? He would ask. Like him, I was born double-jointed and could bend my fingers right back on themselves, and my ankles click when I walk, which made the adults squirm. My mother is very beautiful, and my father adored her, as if she were a fragile china vase, never laying a hand on her, unlike many of our men. Her name, Thor Pekhai, means raven tresses, even though her hair is chestnut brown. My grandfather, Yamseh Khan, had been listening to Radio Afghanistan just before she was born and heard the name. I wished to have the white lily skin, fine features and green eyes, but instead had inherited the sallow complexion, white nose and brown eyes of my father. In our culture, we all have nicknames. Aside from Pisho, which my mother had called me since I was a baby, some of my cousins called me Lachi, which is Pashto for cardamom. Black-skinned people are often called white and short people tall. We have a funny sense of humor. My father was known in the family as Kaista Dada, which means beautiful. When I was around 4 years old, I asked my father, "Abba, what color are you?" He replied, "I don't know, a bit white, a bit black." "It's like when one mixes milk with tea," I said. He laughed a lot, but as a boy he had been so self-conscious about being dark-skinned that he went to the fields to get buffalo milk to spread on his face, thinking it would make him lighter. It was only when he met my mother that he became comfortable in his own skin. Being loved by such a beautiful girl gave him confidence. In our society, marriages are usually arranged by families, but theirs was a love match. I could listen endlessly to the story of how they met. They came from neighboring villages in a remote valley in the upper Swat called Shangla, and would see each other in my father's uncle's courtyard when my mother and her family visited. They glimpsed enough of each other to know that they liked one another. But for us, it is taboo to express such things. Instead, he sent her poems which she could not read. "I admired his mind," she says. "And me, her beauty," he laughs. There was one big problem. My two grandfathers did not get on. So when my father announced his desire to ask for my mother, Torpekai's hand, it was clear neither side would welcome the marriage. His own father said it was up to him and agreed to send a barber as a messenger, which is the traditional way we Pashtuns do this. Malik Yamseh Khan refused the proposal, but my father is a stubborn man and persuaded my grandfather to send the barber again. Yamseh Khan's hujra was a gathering place for people to talk politics, and my father was often there, so they had gotten to know each other. He made him wait 9 months, but finally agreed. My mother comes from a family of strong women as well as influential men. Her grandmother, my great-grandmother, was widowed when her children were young, and her eldest son, Yamseh Khan, was locked up because of a tribal feud with another family when he was only 9. To get him released, she walked 40 miles alone over mountains to appeal to a powerful cousin. I think my mother would do the same for us. Though she cannot read or write, my father shares everything with her, telling her about his day, the good and the bad. She teases him a lot and gives him advice about who she thinks is a genuine friend and who is not. And my father says she is always right. Most Pashtun men never do this, as sharing problems with their women is seen as weak. He even asks his wife, they say, as an insult. I see my parents happy and laughing a lot. People would see us and say we are a sweet family. My mother is very pious and prays 5 times a day, though not in the mosque, as that is only for the men. She disapproves of dancing because she says God would not like it. But she loves to decorate herself with pretty things, embroidered clothes and golden necklaces and bangles. I think I'm a bit of a disappointment to her, as I'm so like my father and don't bother with clothes and jewels. I get bored going to the bazaar, but I love to dance behind closed doors with my school friends. Growing up, we spent most of our time with our mother. My father was out a lot as he was busy, not just with his school, but also with literary societies and jirgas, as well as trying to save the environment, trying to save our valley. My father came from a backward village, yet through education and force of personality, he made a good living for us and a name for himself. People liked to hear him talk, and I loved the evenings when guests visited. we would sit on the floor around a long plastic sheet which my mother laid with food and eat with our right hands, as is our custom, boiling together rice and meat. As darkness fell, we sat by the light of oil lamps, batting away the flies as our silhouettes made dancing shadows on the walls. In the summer months, there would often be thunder and lightning crashing outside, and I would crawl closer to my father's knee. I would listen rapt as he told stories of warring tribes, Pashtun leaders and saints, often through poems that he read in a melodious voice, crying sometimes as he read. Like most people in Swat, we are from the Yusufzai tribe. We Yusufzai are originally from Kandahar and are one of the biggest Pashtun tribes spread across Pakistan and Afghanistan. Our ancestors came to Swat in the 16th century from Kabul, where they helped a Timurid emperor win back his throne after his own tribe removed him. The emperor rewarded them with important positions in the court and army, but his friends and relatives warned him that the Yusufzai were becoming so powerful they would overthrow him. So one night he invited all the chiefs for a banquet and set his men on them while they were eating. Around 600 chiefs were massacred. Only two escaped and they fled to Peshawar, along with their tribesmen. After some time, they went to visit some fellow tribes in Swat to try and win their support to return to Afghanistan. But they were so captivated by the beauty of Swat, they instead decided to stay there and forced the other tribes out. The Yusufzai divided up all the land among the male members of the tribe. It was a peculiar system called Wish, under which every 5 or 10 years, all the families would swap villages and redistribute the land of the new village among the male family members, so that everyone had the chance to work on good as well as bad land. It was thought this would then keep rival clans from fighting. Villages were ruled by khans, and the common people, craftsmen and laborers, were their tenants. They had to pay them rent in kind, usually a share of their crop. They also had to help the khans form their militia by providing an armed man for every small plot of land. Each khan kept hundreds of armed men, both for feuds and to raid and loot other villages. As the Yusufzai and Swat had no ruler, there were constant feuds between the khans and even within their own families. Our men all have rifles, though these days don't walk around with them like they do in other Pashtun areas, and my great-grandfather used to tell stories of gun battles when he was a boy. In the early part of the last century, they became worried about being taken over by the British, who by then controlled most of the surrounding lands. They were also tired of the endless bloodshed, so they decided to try and find an impartial man to rule the whole area and resolve their disputes. After a couple of rulers who did not work out, in 1917, the chiefs settled on a man called Miangal Abdul Wadud as their king. We know him affectionately as Badshah Sahib, and though he was completely illiterate, he managed to bring peace to the valley. Taking a rifle away from a Pashtun is like taking away his life, so he could not disarm the tribes. Instead, he built forts on mountains all across Swat and created an army. He was recognized by the British as the head of state in 1926 and installed as Wali, which is our word for ruler. He set up the first telephone system and built the first primary school and ended the Wesh system, because the constant moving between villages meant no one could sell land or had any incentive to build better houses or plant fruit trees. In 1949, 2 years after the creation of Pakistan, he abdicated in favor of his elder son, Miangul Abdul Haq Jahansab. My father always says while Badshah Sahib brought peace, his son brought prosperity. We think of Jahansab's reign as a golden period in our history. He had studied in a British school in Peshawar, and perhaps because his own father was illiterate, he was passionate about schools and built many, as well as hospitals and roads. In the 1950s, he ended the system where people paid taxes to the khans. There was no freedom of expression, and if anyone criticized the Wali, they could be expelled from the valley. In 1969, the year my father was born, the Wali gave up power and we became part of Pakistan's Northwest Frontier Province, which a few years ago changed its name to Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. So I was born a proud daughter of Pakistan. Though like all Swatis, I thought of myself first as a Swati and then Pashtun, before Pakistani. Near Osanar Street, there was a family with a girl my age called Safina, and two boys similar in age to my brothers, Babar and Basit. We all played cricket in the street or rooftops together, but I knew, as we got older, the girls would be expected to stay inside. We'd be expected to cook and serve our brothers and fathers. While boys and men could roam freely in town, my mother and I could not go out without a male relative to accompany us, even if it was a 5-year-old boy. This was the tradition. I had decided very early I would not be like that. My father always said, "Malala will be free as a bird." I dreamed of going to the top of Mount Elam like Alexander the Great to touch Jupiter, and even beyond the valley. But as I watched my brothers running across the roof, flying their kites and skillfully flicking the strings back and forth to cut each other's down, I wondered how free a daughter could ever be. 2. My father, the falcon. I always knew my father had trouble with words. Sometimes they would get stuck, and he would repeat the same syllable over and over like a record caught in a groove, as we all waited for the next syllable to suddenly pop out. He said it felt like a wall came down in his throat. M's, P's and K's were all enemies lying in wait. I teased him that one of the reasons he called me Jani was because he found it easier to say than Malala. A stutter was a terrible thing for a man who so loved words and poetry. On each side of the family, he had an uncle with the same affliction. But it was almost certainly made worse by his father, whose own voice was a soaring instrument that could make words thunder and dance. "Spit it out, son," he'd roar whenever my father got stuck in the middle of a sentence. My grandfather's name was Rohal Amin, which means honest spirit, and is the holy name of the angel Gabriel. He was so proud of the name that he would introduce himself to people with a famous verse in which his name appears. He was an impatient man at the best of times, and would fly into a rage over the smallest thing, like a hen going astray or a cup getting broken. His face would redden, and he would throw kettles and pots around. I never knew my grandmother, but my father says she used to joke with my grandfather. "By God, just as you greet us only with a frown, when I die, may God give you a wife who never smiles." My grandmother was so worried about my father's stutter that when he was still a young boy, she took him to see a holy man. It was a long journey by bus, then an hour's walk up the hill to where he lived. Her nephew, Fazli Hakim, had to carry my father on his shoulders. The holy man was called Lewano Pir, Saint of the Mad, because he was said to be able to calm lunatics. When they were taken to see the Pir, he instructed my father to open his mouth and then he spat into it. Then he took some gur, dark molasses, made from sugarcane, and rolled it around his mouth to moisten it with spit. He then took the lump out of his mouth and gave it to my grandmother to give to my father, a little each day. The treatment did not cure the stutter. Actually, some people thought it got worse. So when my father was 13 and told my grandfather he was entering a public speaking competition, he was stunned. "How can you?" Rohal Amin asked, laughing. "You take 1 or 2 minutes to utter just one sentence." "Don't worry," replied my father. "You write the speech and I will learn it." My grandfather was famous for his speeches. He taught theology in the government high school in the nearby village of Shahpur. He was also an imam at the local mosque. He was a mesmerizing speaker. His sermons at Friday prayers were so popular that people would come down from the mountains by donkey or on foot to hear him. My father comes from a large family. He had one much older brother, Saeed Ramzan, who I called Uncle Khan Dada, and five sisters. Their village of Barkana was very primitive, and they lived crammed together in a one-story ramshackle house with a mud roof that leaked whenever it rained or snowed. As in most families, the girls stayed at home while the boys went to school. They were just waiting to be married, says my father. School wasn't the only thing my aunts missed out on. In the morning when my father was given cream or milk, his sisters were given tea with no milk. If there were eggs, they would only be for the boys. When a chicken was slaughtered for dinner, the girls would get the wings and the neck, while the luscious breast meat was enjoyed by my father, his brother, and my grandfather. From early on, I could feel I was different from my sisters, my father says. There was little to do in my father's village. It was too narrow even for a cricket pitch, and only one family had a television. On Fridays, the brothers would creep into the mosque and watch in wonder as my grandfather stood at the pulpit and preached to the congregation for an hour or so, waiting for the moment when his voice would rise and practically shake the rafters. My grandfather had studied in India, where he had seen the great speakers and leaders such as Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, Jawaharlal Nehru, Mahatma Gandhi, and Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, our great Pashtun leader who campaigned for independence. Baba, as I called him, had even witnessed the moment of freedom from the British colonialists at midnight on 14th August 1947. He had an old radio set my uncle still has, on which he loved to listen to the news. His sermons were often illustrated by world events or historical happenings, as well as stories from the Quran and the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet. He also liked to talk about politics. Swat had become part of Pakistan in 1969, the year my father was born. Many Swatis were unhappy about this, complaining about the Pakistani justice system, which they said was much slower and less effective than their old tribal ways. My grandfather would rail against the class system, the continuing power of the Khans, and the gap between the have and have-nots. My country may not be very old, but unfortunately, it already has a history of military coups. And when my father was 8, the army chief General Zia-ul-Haq seized power. There are still many pictures of him around. He was a scary man with dark panda shadows around his eyes, large teeth that seemed to stand to attention, and hair pomaded flat on his head. He arrested our elected Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto and had him tried for treason, then hanged from a scaffold in Rawalpindi jail. Even today, people talk of Mr. Bhutto as a man of great charisma. They say he was the first Pakistani leader to stand up for the common people, though he himself was a feudal lord with vast estates of mango fields. His execution shocked everybody and made Pakistan look bad all around the world. The Americans cut off aid. To try to get people at home to support him, General Zia launched a campaign of Islamization to make us a proper Muslim country, with the army as the defenders of our country's ideological as well as geographical frontiers. He told our people it was their duty to obey his government because it was pursuing Islamic principles. Zia even wanted to dictate how we should pray and set up salat or prayer committees in every district, even in our remote village, and appointed 100,000 prayer inspectors. Before then, mullahs had almost been figures of fun. My father said, at wedding parties they would just hang around in a corner and leave early. But under Zia, they became influential and were called to Islamabad for guidance on sermons. Even my grandfather went. Under Zia's regime, life for women in Pakistan became much more restricted. Our founder Jinnah said, "No struggle can ever succeed without women participating side by side with men. There are two powers in the world. One is the sword and the other is the pen. There is a third power stronger than both, that of women." But General Zia brought in Islamic laws which reduced a woman's evidence in court to count for only half that of a man's. Soon, our prisons were full of cases, like that of a 13-year-old girl who was raped and became pregnant, and was then sent to prison for adultery because she couldn't produce 4 male witnesses to prove it was a crime. A woman couldn't even open a bank account without a man's permission. As a nation, we have always been good at hockey, but Zia made our female hockey players wear baggy trousers instead of shorts and stopped women playing some sports altogether. Many of our madrasas or religious schools were opened at that time, and in all schools religious studies, what we call diniyat, was replaced by Islamiyat or Islamic studies, which children in Pakistan still have to do today. Our history textbooks were rewritten to describe Pakistan as a fortress of Islam, which made it seem as if we had existed far longer than since 1947, and denounced Hindus and Jews. Anyone reading them might think we won the 3 wars we had fought and lost against our great enemy, India. Everything changed when my father was 10. Just after Christmas, 1979, the Russians invaded our neighbor Afghanistan. Millions of Afghans fled across our border, and General Zia gave them refuge. Vast camps of white tents sprang up mostly around Peshawar, some of which are still there today. Our biggest intelligence service belongs to the military and is called the ISI, and they started a massive program to train Afghan refugees recruited from the camps as resistance fighters or mujahideen. Though Afghans are renowned fighters, Colonel Imam, the officer heading the program, complained that trying to organize Afghans was like weighing frogs. The Russian invasion transformed Zia from an international pariah to the great defender of freedom in the Cold War. The Americans became friends with us once again, as in those days Russia was their main enemy. Next door to us, the Shah of Iran had been overthrown in a revolution a few months earlier, so the CIA had lost their main base in our region. Pakistan took its place. Billions of dollars flowed into our exchequer from the United States and other Western countries, as well as weapons to help the ISI train the Afghans to fight the Communist Red Army. General Zia was invited to meet the American President Ronald Reagan at the White House and British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher at 10 Downing Street. They lavished praise on him. Prime Minister Bhutto had appointed Zia as his army chief because he thought he was not very intelligent and would not be a threat. He called him his monkey, but Zia turned out to be a very wily man. He made Afghanistan a rallying point, not only for the West, which wanted to stop the spread of communism from the Soviet Union, but also for Muslims from Sudan to Tajikistan, who saw it as a fellow Islamic country under attack from infidels. Money poured in from all over the Arab world, particularly Saudi Arabia, which matched whatever the US sent, and volunteer fighters too, including a Saudi millionaire called Osama bin Laden. We Pashtuns are split between Pakistan and Afghanistan and don't really recognize the border that the British drew more than 100 years ago. So our blood boiled over the Soviet invasion for both religious and nationalist reasons. The clerics of the mosques would often talk about the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in his sermons, condemning the Russians as infidels and urging people to rise up and join the fight or jihad, saying it was their duty as good Muslims. It was as if under Zia, jihad had become a sixth pillar of our religion, on top of the 5 we grew up to learn. The belief in one God, namaz or prayers 5 times a day, giving zakat or alms, roza, fasting from dawn till sunset during the month of Ramadan, and hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, which every able-bodied Muslim should do once in their lifetime. My father says that in our part of the world, this idea of jihad was very much encouraged by the CIA. Children in the refugee camps were even given school textbooks produced by an American university which taught basic arithmetic through fighting. They had sums like, if out of 10 Russian infidels, 5 are killed by 1 Muslim, 5 would be left. Or, 15 bullets minus 10 bullets equals 5 bullets. Some boys from my father's district went off to fight in Afghanistan. My father remembers that one day a Maulana called Sufi Muhammad came to the village and asked young men to join him to fight the Russians in the name of Islam. Many did, and they set off, armed with old rifles or just axes and bazookas. Little did we know that years later the same Maulana's organization would become the Swat Taliban. At that time of Sufi Muhammad's visit, my father was only 12 years old and too young to fight. But the Russians ended up stuck in Afghanistan for 10 years, through most of the 1980s, and when he became a teenager, my father decided he too wanted to be a jihadi. Though later he became less regular in his prayers. In those days he used to leave home at dawn every morning to walk to a mosque in another village where he studied the Quran with a senior talib. At that time, the word talib simply meant religious student. Together, they studied all the 30 chapters of the Quran. Not just recitation, but also interpretation, something few boys do. The talib talked of jihad in such glorious terms that my father was captivated. He would endlessly point out to my father that life on earth was short and that there were few opportunities for young men in the village. Our family owned little land, and my father did not want to end up going south to work in the coal mines like many of his classmates. That was tough and dangerous work, and the coffins of those killed in accidents would come back several times a year. The best that most village boys could hope for was to go to Saudi Arabia or Dubai and work in construction. So the idea of heaven with its 72 virgins sounded attractive. Every night my father would pray to God, "O Allah, please make war between Muslims and infidels so I can die in your service and be a martyr." For a while, his Muslim identity seemed more important than anything else in his life. He began to sign himself Ziauddin Panjshiri. The Panjshiri are a religious sect, and sprouted the first signs of a beard. It was, he says, a kind of brainwashing. He believes he might even have thought of becoming a suicide bomber, had there been such a thing in those days. But from an early age, he had been a questioning kind of boy who rarely took anything at face value, even though our education at government schools meant learning by rote and pupils were not supposed to question teachers. It was around the time he was praying to go to heaven as a martyr that he met my mother's brother, Faiz Muhammad, and started mixing with her family and going to her father's hujra. They were very involved in local politics, belonged to secular nationalist parties, and were against involvement in the war. A famous poem was written at that time by Rehmat Shah Sahil, the same Peshawar poet who wrote the poem about my namesake. He described what was happening in Afghanistan as a war between two elephants, the US and the Soviet Union, not our war, and said that we Pashtuns were like the grass crushed by the hooves of two fierce beasts. My father often used to recite the poem to me when I was a child, but I did not know then what it meant. My father was particularly influenced by Faiz Muhammad and thought he talked a lot of sense, particularly about wanting to end the feudal and capitalist system in our country where the same big families had controlled things for years while the poor got poorer. He found himself torn between the two extremes, secularism and socialism on one side and militant Islam on the other. I guess he ended up somewhere in the middle. My father was in awe of my grandfather and told me wonderful stories about him. But he also told me that he was a man who could not meet the high standards he set for others. Baba was such a popular and passionate speaker that he could have been a great leader if he had been more diplomatic and less consumed by rivalries with cousins and others who are better off. In Pashtun society, it's very hard to stomach a cousin being more popular, wealthier, or more influential than you are. My grandfather had a cousin who also joined his school as a teacher. When he got the job, he gave his age as much younger than that of my grandfather. Our people don't know their exact dates of birth, My mother, for example, does not know when she was born. We tend to remember years by events, like the year of the earthquake. But my grandfather knew that his cousin was actually much older than him. He was so angry that he made the day-long bus journey to Mingora to see the Swat Minister of Education. "Sahib," he told him, "I have a cousin who is 10 years older than me, and you have certified him 10 years younger." So the minister said, "Okay, Maulana, what shall I write down for you? Would you like to have been born in the year of the earthquake of Quetta?" My grandfather agreed. So his new date of birth became 1935, making him much younger than his cousin. This family rivalry meant that my father was bullied a lot by his cousins. They knew he was insecure about his looks because at school the teachers always favored the handsome boys for their fair skin. His cousins would stop my father on the way home from school, teasing him about being short and dark-skinned. In our society, you have to take revenge for such slights, but my father was much smaller than his cousins.